1968, Vietnam and campus unrest led a discussion at the University of Illinois to be broadcast around the country.
It was kind of surreal because, right, you're looking at this film and it's in the past, but many of the issues that they are discussing in the telecast are very much so prevalent today.
That's Porsche Gardner. Today, a new conversation in the same room 50 years later, and we ask, what's changed and what hasn't? Plus, the new movie Shot in the Dark, executive produced by Chance the Rapper and Dwayne Wade, and directed and produced by two Chicagoans, tells the story of basketball players who tragically encounter shots on and off the court. We talk with two of the players and filmmakers. And we speak with another candidate running for governor in our series of chats, today Superintendent Bob Diber from Madison County. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. On a February evening in 1968, students, faculty, and activists from around the country gathered at the University of Illinois' Student Union. Tensions were high. Student protests over racial inequality, Vietnam, Dow Chemical's use of napalm, and their recruiting on college campuses had administrators looking for a way to quell tensions. Originally, it was slated as a conversation about, quote, student power and campus unrest, but the discussion quickly shifted to focus on racial inequality.
The fact of the matter is quite clearly that this institution, which is the major institution which shapes white America, and I think black America as well, has shown itself absolutely incapable of dealing with the critical social problems we have. I mean, the dam has burst. It's clear.
That's a clip from the Public Broadcasting Laboratory. When they aired this discussion nationally in 1968, viewers from around the country tuned in to watch the discussion that happened at the University of Illinois. Now, 50 years later, U of I Provost Fellow Kevin Hamilton is organizing an event to revisit that conversation and the issues. This Sunday, the original discussion is going to be screened at the University Student Union 50 years to the day after the original conversation. After the film, there'll be a discussion that will also be filmed. Seating is limited for the event. We're going to tweet out the information if you'd like to RSVP if you're in the Central Illinois area. But right now, for everyone else, we've gathered a few people in our Urbana studios who will be at the event this Sunday. Kevin is with me. I'm also joined by Karen Olowu, who's a student at the University of Illinois. She's also a member of Black Students for Revolution. And Porsche Gardner is with me. She's with Saving Our Lives, Hear Our Truths. And she's also going to be performing at the event. All of you, thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So this discussion, Kevin, can I just start with you and ask, how did you come to find out about this original film and discussion or this original broadcast that took place 50 years ago?
I came across this by accident when I was researching other histories of Illinois. When I moved to a place like I did here in 2002, I like to know what else happened there before I was there. I like to know what stories get told and don't get told about a place. And one of the stories that hadn't been told much when I got here was the story of a cybernetics research lab that used to be a center of political action here on campus.
And that's what led you to this?
Yes, I came across a record of this broadcast in the records of a cybernetics research laboratory here on campus.
And Porsche, you've seen this discussion. What was your thought as you're watching? It's an hour-long televised discussion between students and administrators and students from all over the country. And then there's a group of Black students and student organizers that are there too. What were your thoughts when you first saw this?
When I first saw the telecast, it was kind of surreal because, right, you're looking at this film and it's in the past, but many of the issues that they are discussing in the telecast are very much so prevalent today, especially as it relates to the tension on the campus, as well as the relationship that the university has to the larger Champaign-Urbana community. So it was kind of like, oh, we can kind of sub out some of these things and put in present day issues, and we could have the same conversation, but more so interested also in thinking about how can we get beyond this conversation.
Karen, what were your thoughts?
In a lot of ways, very similar to Porsche's thoughts. One of the things that was so striking to me about the film was the frankness of the students and even to some degree the frankness of the administrators. Nowadays, I don't think we could have that kind of conversation in just that kind of very forthrightness. Even the administrators were willing to approach the students in a way that's much more forthright than is common nowadays. I guess the term would be political correctness has kind of become the modus operandi of not just administrators, but faculty and students. And that, I think, distracts from our ability to have honest conversations. And so it was so refreshing just to see students saying exactly what was on their mind, and to some degree, administrators responding in kind. And so I hope that the conversation that we'll be having on the 25th will be able to replicate some of that forthrightness.
And some of that forthrightness comes from John Lee Johnson, who I think for people in the Champaign area and Champaign-Urbana area may know his activism. But for people who aren't, Kevin, can you tell us a little bit more about him and what role he had in the discussion 50 years ago?
Sure. John Lee Johnson was there as one of the leaders of the Black students in the discussion, despite the fact that he was not a student. Mm-hmm. He was a leader in the civic community here, accomplished a lot of great things for this town in terms of equality of housing, equality of schooling, ended up on city council, many things like that. But at that point, the student movement and the local community movement were working together, mm-hmm. and that's his presence there is a sign of that.
Let's play a little clip from the discussion. This is John Lee Johnson responding to comments from a white student from the University of California.
I've been on pickets with against the war in South Vietnam with white people, you know? So don't tell me, and I know some white people who picket and will picket all night against the war in South Vietnam, don't give a hang about a black person. See?
You don't believe so don't in tell, liberation struggle?
Don't jump on this bag
with
me here. I ask you one question. I ask all the students in here, I ask the faculty members, where are the universities in the problems in the society here in dealing with blacks and whites? Where are the students at? You tell me where they are. Don't give me no South Vietnam bag. Don't give me no hang up on no Dow Chemical Company.
So I wonder, let me just explain a little bit of the context there. That was activist John Lee Johnson, the 1968 film broadcast from the Public Broadcasting Laboratory. This conversation that was happening on campus. Kevin, can you just explain a little of the history of this, of Dow Chemicals and what was happening at the time and what people were protesting about on campuses in 1968?
Sure. And actually, it was in the fall of 67 that the Dow Corporation came through on a recruitment tour across a lot of the bigger universities in the Midwest. They were recruiting, as companies do today, trying to get top talent for their companies. But of course, Dow was known at that time for the development of napalm, the terrible weapon that was being used in Vietnam at the time. There were protests at every campus where Dow recruited during fall of 67, and every one of them but this campus resulted in blood. Yeah. This was the only campus where the protest resulted instead in an expulsion of a few students. Mm. The students here staged a sit-in to prevent access to that recruitment session and were expelled as a result of that.
Mm. Karen, did you know about this history before you saw this discussion?
To some degree, but only because of the archival work that I've been doing with Black Students for Revolution. And so in trying to recover the hidden history of Black student work on this campus in the 60s, we've stumbled across the work of white students as well. But I wouldn't know if not looking through the old pieces of the DI, which was actually incredible in the 60s and 70s. The DI was an amazing newspaper. But I think it was shocking to me in that a lot of times nowadays, older people, so people who were perhaps in their 20s in the 60s, will say that students nowadays are so rambunctious or were aggressive. And I'm like, y'all were some aggressives. Right. We ain't nowhere near as aggressive as y'all. Like, y'all were like sitting in, you know, quitting class, throwing rocks, you know, getting arrested. Like, we ain't even getting arrested yet. And you want to call us like being that like, we're too radical. So I think it was just interesting how willing students were to be politically active, how willing students were to actively shape their communities, and also the astuteness of the analysis of white students, that they were able to connect the University of Illinois, a publicly funded university, to the work of capitalist, like, weapons manufacturers, that these companies are manufacturing weapons using our brilliance, right, to manufacture weapons that are being used to kill indigenous people in Vietnam. And so the fact that white students and black students and Latino students were able to make those connections and willing to act upon those connections, I think was absolutely incredible.
That's Karen Alowu. She's a student. She's with Black Students for Revolution at the University of Illinois. Kevin Hamilton is with me as well. He's a provost fellow at the U of I. Porsche Garner is with us as well, with a community organization in Champaign-Urbana called Saving Our Lives, Hear Our Truths. And we're talking about this 1968 conversation. So 50 years ago, this happened here in Urbana at the University of Illinois. And so these students, just to kind of, I want to play a lot. There's a lot of, it gets really tense, to mm-hmm. your point, Karen, right, mm-hmm. about this frankness. So it gets really tense because originally this conversation is supposed to be about Dow Chemicals and napalm. And the Black students are in that conversation saying, what about us? Why? What about inequities that are happening right here in this country? And actually, there's a point where the majority of the Black students actually end up walking out of the discussion. And I just wanted to play another clip from one of these really intense moments in that conversation.
For these Black people to come in and vent a pent of frustration on people who are obviously not oppressing them. Their oppressors are quite obvious, and if they want to take a force against them, I suggest that they go and do that instead of mouthing off against people who spend quite a bit of their lives trying to help
them. What the hell have you done to
it? It is an obvious fact that those people who talk the most, when it comes right down to it, that's the actual violence. They're not the ones who do it.
You're probably right there. You know.
Okay.
So that means Governor Wallace, who's running his mouth off, all the white people who are running around this country running their mouths off, who are sending me to South Bend now, and there's boys like you who don't know nothing, who ain't never done nothing, and all you want to do is call somebody a nigger, keep things down, and you're going to sit here on your behind and tell me what niggers ought to be doing, and what you know about Black people ain't nothing, what you know about white people ain't nothing. So shut your
you
mouth,
are nothing.
Because what you know about
I
me ain't nothing.
I don't give a holy damn about that. Your I know problem.
That. I think we're uncovering racism in America.
That's University of Illinois student Fred Landis addressing John Lee Johnson in this discussion. Karen and Porsche, I want to ask both of you about that moment because it does get really intense, right? And I wonder if you all feel like those conversations about racial tension and inequity are having that same, are those conversations happening right now at the University of Illinois? Would you like to see them happen at that level of intensity? Porsche, let me start with you.
Okay, so I will respond and say that these conversations are happening, especially if we think about 2015, where there was a big rise in student organizing around the country on campuses. So I'm thinking about Mizzou, I'm thinking about here. That's actually how Kevin and I, one of the connections, many connections that he and I have is through the things that were going on campus here at the University of Illinois. So I also did organizing with Standing With Her, which we were organizing around issues for Black women, professors and workers and students on campus, and really trying to push the university on taking a stance to support Black women and women of color. So there was a art piece that was installed on the union, at the union on the back quad. And Kevin reached out to us and wanted to know how he could collaborate with us in order to kind of have a discussion around art and the humanities, which is, you know, rarely not had, or the two shall be separate. And we collaborated with the the School of Art and Design, and we were able to fund some of the programming that we were a part of, specifically Black Girl Genius Week. So the organizations and the spaces that I'm a part of, we're always talking about race and issues of inequity as they disenfranchise many bodies on campus. We had that year, we had the opportunity to meet with administrators who very frankly told us, like, you know, you should have chosen differently if you wanted a different outcome. So those conversations were not about the future of students, because all the organizing that I'm doing, I don't think my time here at Illinois is coming to an end shortly. So I don't think it'll be realized in my time, but everything that I'm doing is specifically for people who will come after me, so that the situation is not the same. Unlike that administrator who told me, you know, you should have chosen differently. Like, what can we do? This is the situation. You chose to come here. So I do think that there are conversations continuously being had. We had students sit in with the Salida issue. So students are thinking about the same issues that the students in 1968 were thinking about as it relates to speaking out against administration and really holding the administration responsible for the for the decisions that they're making as it relates to students and our learning.
Karen, do you have expectations of what you think will happen on Sunday evening in terms of a discussion, especially as you look back to that discussion 50 years ago and what you would like to see happen now?
No, I don't have. Well, I do have expectations, but they're not high. And the reason is because I haven't, and the students that I work with haven't had the same degree of success, it seems, as Porsche, you and standing with her have had. In terms of having these conversations, because while they're certainly happening in certain student spaces, it's not across the board. All student organizations aren't having these kinds of conversations. And in terms of this conversation happening between administrators and students and faculty, it's not happening at all. University administrators refuse to have public conversations about these issues because I think, to be honest, they're cowardly. I think they're very cowardly. And so this is a public challenge to any administrator, any faculty, the Illini Republicans, whoever is out there. If you want to have a public conversation, a public debate with Black Students for Revolution about these issues, we ready for you. So come on.
And Kevin, we're out of time, unfortunately. But really quickly, are you hoping some of these discussions will happen this weekend?
Yes, I think we need a reimagining of how these conversations mm-hmm. happen. I think we need to take our cue from communities of color and especially Black communities that I think have found a lot better methods and methodologies and approaches and patterns with which to have intergenerational conversations, conversations that address the whole person and not just a divided part of the self. And so I'm hoping that we get a good start here on a different way of doing this.
That's Kevin Hamilton. I want to thank him. Again, that discussion is happening this weekend. Thanks also to Porsche Garner and Karen Alowu, who's with Black Students for Revolution. All of you, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it.
The 21st is supported by the University of Illinois Press, publisher of scholarly and regional interest books and journals, allowing local and global readers to understand and engage with the changing world. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years of publishing.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In a new documentary produced and directed by two Chicago natives and executive produced by Dwayne Wade and fellow Chicagoan Chance the Rapper, young basketball stars from Orr Academy on the West Side are hoping their skills get them into college or the NBA. They're also hoping to stay safe. And so the title, Shot in the Dark, you don't know whether that's a game-winning shot or a gunshot. And it turns out, in the case of featured player Tyquan Greer, it's both.
Who would ever, ever, ever thought Orr would be going downstate, man? You guys, man, are truly and simply amazing, man. We've been through a lot.
That's their coach, Lou Adams, on the film, which has its broadcast premiere on Fox tomorrow night at 3:30 Central. It shares Tyquan's story as well as his teammate, Marquise Pryor. We've got so many folks here to talk about the film, but I want to start by welcoming two stars of the film, Marquise Pryor and Tyquan Greer. Hey, guys, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So, Tyquan, in the movie, you're a high school senior and you're a rising basketball star. And I think folks might remember this story because this happened a couple years ago. In your senior year, you were hit with a stray bullet after a party in Austin. This was reported, as I mentioned, by a lot of different news media at the time. What was it like to relive this on film?
It was the feeling just like you just can't really just put it in words. Just to actually see all the things we went through and was able to actually overcome it and see it on film is amazing, because not a lot of people are able to capture moments like that on film and be able to go back and watch it. So the fact that we actually able to display our story to the world, I mean, was just it's crazy.
Yeah, and Marquise, I wanted to ask you about that too, because at the beginning of the film, you're in prison, and when you come out, it seems like there's this entire community that comes out to greet you. We actually have a moment of that we want to play, okay?
All right.
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. Huh? Ready to work? Yeah, I'm ready.
And your coach is there, your teammates, and that scene, if you didn't even see the sheriff, I think you might not even know what you're seeing. It's really joyful. Did you expect to see so much support that day?
So, you know, I had a strong support system behind me. So I know at the end of the day, like, no matter what, like, my family was going to be out there. And everyone you seen in the film was basically like family. You know what I'm saying? From the people in the community, from the people I attended school with, and, you know, as well as my family.
Yeah, and I think the thing that struck me when I was watching this is there's so much pressure on you guys, right? There's you, there's the sport. That kind of pressure builds as the film goes on with the team's success, with your survival. Taekwon, I want to ask you about that because that's the reality, but you also were, you were a teenager. Were there moments where, when this was going through this, where you kind of felt like this was a lot that you had resting on your shoulders?
Because like I said, in the film, like I heard the word potential a lot. Like people always told me I had potential to be great, but being from where I'm from, it was just hard to see because of what we were so used to seeing and being around. You're like, okay, all these people have potential, and yet they still here with us. It just made it hard on me because I'm like, okay, I got potential. How am I supposed to take my potential and help myself become better so that I can make it to the next level? And at that point in time, it was draining because I didn't have the guidance that I really wanted and needed to help me bring my potential to the fullest point so that I could move on to the next level. So it was kind of hard for me. And at times, I just wanted to give up. And I didn't see myself going anywhere, but I was blessed to have being Dusty and Dan and also Coach Lou in my life to help me, you know, stay focused and to keep my mind on the right path and to know that I'm going to always be who I am.
We're talking to Taekwon Greer and Marquise Pryor. They're the stars of Shot in the Dark. It's going to have its broadcast premiere on Fox tomorrow. And Dusty and Dan are with us now. That's director Dustin Nakao-Hedder and producer Daniel Poneman, who's with us. Hey, guys, thanks for being with me as well.
Thank you.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Daniel, I wanted to play another part of the film because Taekwon was just talking about this, or Academy coach Lou Adams. And it's actually a part of him giving a pregame talk to the Spartans basketball team.
You're not talking about basketball. I'm talking about the game of life. Y'all think this is a game out here, man. They're going to kill y'all. They're going to kill y'all, man.
You think he's talking about the other team, but then we go on to understand this isn't just kind of your ordinary basketball coach pep talk. And Daniel, I want to ask you about this because you sort of had a parallel experience like this yourself, right? You didn't end up making this movie you originally thought you were going to make. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, initially, when we were talking about making this film, we were looking at different basketball players that we could consider in the city of Chicago. And some of them were really, you know, big star players who, like Jabari Parker or Jahlil Okafor, you know, guys who were in the spotlight who made it to the NBA. And when we really decided on Marquise and Taekwon, initially it was supposed to be a short film. It was supposed to be 10 minutes. And we decided that we wanted to tell a really true Chicago story. You know, the superstar player story, there's only a handful of kids that ever get that experience. But we really wanted to tell Taekwon and Marquise's story because it is a true Chicago story. There are a lot of kids, you know, their story is unique in some ways, but in some ways it's a story of every kid who had hoop dreams coming through Chicago. Once the camera started rolling and we kind of just fell in love with their stories and with the community, you know, 6 years later, here we are with a feature film.
Yeah, Dustin, what were you, I mean, did you go into this with expectations of what you thought this was going to be?
From my perspective, you know, I was living in New York at the time, and there were so many kind of, this was, you know, imagine like 2011, 2012, there were so many pervasive narratives of violence that were coming out in sort of the mainstream media. And, you know, growing up in Evanston and sort of feeling like there had to be, you know, I felt like there had to be more beyond just like what these sort of big sensationalistic headlines were saying. So the goal was always to try and get beneath the headlines and try and find, you know, a more humanist perspective that could kind of shed light on what the reality of living in these neighborhoods in Chicago can be like. And so Dan's work in the community is kind of, you know, already been well covered, but he has a huge amount of respect in the neighborhood. So reaching out to him, I knew that we'd be able to figure out the right characters to kind of tell the story. And little did we know we'd be meeting, you know, these amazing people in Taekwon and Marquise and being able to tell their stories.
So Dan, as Dustin was just saying, your background is as a basketball scout. So you were searching for talent on the court. And I was thinking about that when I was watching this. What a tough job that must be, watching all of these young men playing and thinking of the sort of enormous responsibility it is to find somebody to pick. What made you start thinking about player stories in terms of what you've seen?
Well, you know, this career kind of chose me. I didn't really decide one day I'm going to be a basketball scout. It's not really something you can choose if you wanted to. It was kind of thrust upon me organically. Growing up as a kid in Evanston, I played all around the city and I got to know all the kids. And I started a website when I was in high school, and coaches just started reaching out to me because I had the information. And it is a great responsibility, and it does weigh on me sometimes. If there's a kid who maybe I really want to help but isn't good enough to play college basketball, there's not much I can do to help. The colleges give free education. You know, luckily, the kids like Taekwon and Marquise who can play basketball, but so many other kids don't get that opportunity. But, you know, through my time being a scout and being in Chicago, I've seen so many amazing stories of kids who have overcome just like so many incredible things to make it to college and come back to their community and be teachers and coaches and mentors and give back to their community. So when I got this opportunity to work with Dustin and Ben to tell one of these stories, I was excited not only at the opportunity, but at the people I got to work with, because there's so many people who have tried to tell Chicago stories, but have told them in dishonest or sensationalized ways. But like Dustin as a director was just such an honest, thoughtful person. I learned more, you know, about my experience as a basketball scout just from seeing it through Dustin's camera and being with him every day. I got to learn more about what I was actually a part of and what our community is about and what so many of these things mean to the community. So it's been an amazing experience for me in a lot of ways.
Taekwon, to that point, you talk about segregation in Chicago, both racial and economic, and you described it as a quicksand you can get stuck in. For you, did you always see basketball as a way out of that?
We used that as a safe haven. Like, whenever we felt like we was going through something, well, not even just say we use it as a safe haven, but basketball was just always that positive energy that we needed, and we endured because, I mean, a lot of my teammates, even though, I mean, they're not on the right path, but I know for a fact when they play basketball take away all those negative thoughts, all those problems that they're going through, and basketball was just that positive thing in our life that we all use. It helped me a ton. That's why I'm still playing basketball today.
And Dustin, I wanted to ask you about all of that. Dan was talking about Chicago, and I think especially as we think about the headlines that we see out of Chicago, this movie is going to be broadcast on Saturday on Fox to a national audience. What do you hope people outside of Chicago will come to understand about maybe not just the city, but even just this one neighborhood from watching this film?
Yeah, I mean, to have this opportunity with Fox to bring the film to a national audience is obviously a huge blessing. The last thing we'd want to do is to kind of perpetuate more generalizations or more cliches that maybe people kind of feel like they already know. You know, my goal and my hope in terms of takeaways is just that people can understand the kind of commonality between, you know, a kid growing up on the west side of Chicago and any other kid in this country that has ambitions or dreams. You know, we just see that in Taekwon and Marquise's situation, and a lot of kids in these sort of disenfranchised neighborhoods in Chicago, those dreams aren't as always easily achievable. But, you know, when you see statistics and numbers or headlines in Chicago, I hope that a film like this can kind of help you understand what goes on beyond that. Like in Marquise's situation, you know, it's easy to look at the headline and see that, you know, a young kid was arrested for having a gun, but then when you fully understand what Marquise was going through in that moment, in the sense that if he doesn't have the gun, his life is in danger. And so if he does have the gun, he has the threat of being arrested and just sort of the complications for that. And I think that one of the strengths that we found in screening the film and how people responded to it is that we put the viewer in that situation or in that person's shoes for that moment, you know, and you can see the how these issues aren't black and white. There's a huge gray area here, and something like basketball is something that I think a big audience can at least understand and is easily digestible, because wins and losses on a basketball court are black and white, whereas the issues that the kids are dealing with off the court are not always so easy.
Well, and when you say basketball, there's also some pretty big names that are executive produced. Dwayne Wade, Chance the Rapper. Dustin, how did that relationship come about?
They kind of each came in at different parts of the process. In Wade's case, we had had like a 5 to 7 minute short preview that we'd been using to help finance the film and garner interest. And Wade's team had got their eyes on it at that sort of early part in the process before we had even started editing. And Wade just immediately identified with the kids. You know, he grew up in the South Side and in Robbins, and, you know, his story with his mother and the issues that they face is pretty well tracked, but you know, he identified with the kids and identified with their struggle, and what they were going through was no different than what he experienced. And at that point, he kind of decided he wanted to come aboard the project and help us in any way he could. In Chance's case, Daniel's had a long relationship with him and his team. I met Chance back in 2012, I think. We did a short video shoot with him way back when, and his team has sort of known about the film for a while, but then it was kind of when he and his nonprofit organization, Social Works, started doing all this philanthropic work, and the New Chance Fund, which they donated a bunch of money to OR. I think that was, Dan probably knows the dates better than me. I think that was last year, last fall. And at that point, we just sort of saw that there was this like really great opportunity for our story and the work that he was doing with Social Work, where there was a great overlap.
We're almost out of time, but Marquise, I just wanted to ask you, I don't want to give away anything for the film because it's really amazing and everyone should see it, and I want them to kind of watch it along. But Marquise, what are you up to now?
Basically, what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to become a motivational speaker, trying to get certified, get all my hours in so I can be a certified motivational speaker, and I'm pushing my own clothing line.
All right, thanks. Hey, Taekwon, I wanted to just ask you one more question. One of the things that the movie captures really nicely is the relationship between you and your mom. And you say at one point that everything you do is because of your mom and it's for your mom. And I'm wondering how she reacted to seeing the film.
She enjoyed the film a lot. The fact she was there with us along the journey that we through the film. So she was there and she was able to walk along with me through the steps, and everything that I was going through, she was able to be there. So my mom is not at her best right now. So if I can make it, I will be able to help my mom. So with that being said, the fact that she's going through what she's going through is motivate me to do what I got to do in order to make sure that my family is situated.
Yeah.
So I use her struggle and my struggle to help keep pushing. So everything I'm doing is for us. And as you know, I got a son also. I just had a son last year, born on my birthday. So that just added fuel to the fire. So it makes me want to make it more and more. So everything is working out as according.
Yeah. Well, best wishes to you and your family, both of you guys. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. That's Taekwon Greer and Marquise Pryor. You can see them in Shot in the Dark. It's directed by Dustin Nikau Hedder, and Daniel Poneman is the producer, and it's going to be on Vox tomorrow, 3:30 in the afternoon. Hey, guys, thanks so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you've been listening this week, you've heard some of our conversations with candidates running for governor. We've recorded 7 of them. There are 6 Democrats running and 2 Republicans. One of them is the incumbent current governor, Bruce Rauner. Just to let you know, we've reached out to Governor Rauner's campaign office repeatedly to invite him to join us on the show, but have not received a response. He is welcome anytime. The primary is March 20th. Today, I'm joined by Democratic candidate Bob Diber. He's superintendent of the Madison County Regional Office of Education. He's been a school teacher, served on a village board, county board, and as a township supervisor. He's also the only Democratic governor candidate from outside the Chicago area. He lives in Marine, Illinois. That's the southwest part of the state, closer to St. Louis. He also owns a farm in Alhambra Township in the county. Superintendent Diber, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much for having me.
Illinois went more than 2 years without a full budget. We know that the most vulnerable people in our state were hit hard by that and in many ways are still recovering. Why should voters entrust you with helping make sure that doesn't happen again?
Well, as a member of units of government, I was one of the individuals also impacted by that. So I know the direct effect because, schools were waiting for funds. For especially categorical payments, units of government were waiting for funds to reinstate services. And having been a local elected official, I saw the impact directly. So as governor, I would not impose those types of stresses on schools or on the units of government. And I will be responsible to see that there's a budget in place each and every year. I think the reason that voters should trust me is because I understand how to govern and I understand the process that takes place on a calendar year. And I continue to campaign and try to explain that to constituents.
We have been asking our listeners via social media to chime in with questions they want to ask. And we got a question from Reddit that I imagine is on the mind of many people in our state. And it gets to this, not just the budget impasse, but the problems that we've been seeing in Springfield. How do you plan to work, whether across the aisle or within your own party, to make sure that things actually get done?
Well, I think you have to go to Springfield with an open mind. You have to be willing to compromise. You have to be willing to collaborate. And the polarization in the state has got to relax. We've worked to create divisions between Chicago and the rest of the state. There's been efforts of disparity that have been discussed. And the first and foremost thing I think that you need to have as a governor is a person who's going to come in with the willingness to try to get along with people. I think that's what's not happening at this time, is that I have no personal agenda but to make Illinois a better place and to pay its bills, submit a manageable budget, and to move Illinois out of the debt that we currently experience and bring to Springfield a new vision of open-mindedness and roll up our sleeves to tackle some of the really tough problems that are there. And it's going to take a group effort, not just the governor, to get this done. So I intend to work with legislators from day one to be part of my initiatives to resolve these issues and to get Illinois sound again.
Let's talk taxes for a minute, Superintendent. The tax question has obviously been a big issue as the state looks for more revenue. Last year, we saw our individual income tax rate go from 3.75% to 4.95%. The corporate tax rate went up to 7%. You have a plan to do with this away with this flat tax rate for individuals. What would that look like?
Well, I've laid out a progressive tax model right after the first of this year, and that tax model is a progressive tax. That's a scale from 1 to 6%, and I'm the only candidate that's running that's put hard numbers to it. Individuals that are, I call them middle-class taxpayers, $45,000 to $150,000, would actually go back to the other tax rate of 3.75, and then we would move upwards from there of $150,000 and more, paying the current rate of 4.95. But residents who earn $1 million or more would pay 6%. Also, if we back up on the model, individuals making $45,000 and less and those making $25,000 and less would pay a lesser portion of tax. So those individuals have greater earning powers in our economy. The one thing that this model does that has gotten some people's attention is I've said everybody needs to pay 1%. And that includes retirees, because we have to have a way in which we're going to pay for our pension system.
I mentioned at the beginning that you own a farm. Agriculture has been part of you and your wife's family for generations. You've talked about banning the pesticide dicamba. Why is this important to you?
Well, it's a growing issue in Illinois. There was 246 claims made just this last year. And that's staggering, that over 50% of the claims that were made on pesticides was because of this one chemical. And as this seed system expands in Illinois, I think we're going to see greater litigation, an increased number of claims. We do not have the safety policies in place for this. It's a highly controversial, highly debated pesticide. States such as Arkansas and states as Missouri issued some sorts of bans on this herbicide this past year. And I believe Illinois is going to be very vulnerable to this in this coming planting season. Therefore, before individuals invest in this as they do prepay programs with seed companies, I think they need to be aware of the hazards of this and cautiously proceed forward so they don't wind up in litigation this next year.
Superintendent Diber, you mentioned education, and as a superintendent facing the effects of the budget impasse firsthand, I wanted to ask you about the state of public education. Certainly, I think many would say, most people would agree that it's suffered in the past few years, whether we're talking about K-12 school funding and the most inequitable system in the country, or our state's largest universities. Do you believe our public educational institutions need more state funding?
Well, I think the state needs a more proportional share and responsible funding mechanism. And our problem has been is that we've relied upon property tax system, which is a 19th century concept. It's annotated. It doesn't provide the adequate funds. It continues to ask local property owners to increase revenues for schools because the state has been not willing to do so. And the reason I laid out the progressive income tax model is because that is how we begin moving to a system in which we can generate revenue from. Schools were drastically affected by the proration of general state aid for 3 years. I do give Governor Runner credit in that he upped that proration, but we're still not there. And I have said this as governor, that my first appropriation bill would be to fund public education. I've also said that I would return to the 2012 funding level, the last year that we really funded higher education at a level that it was able to substantiate itself. So, you know, prioritizing your budget, no matter how much revenue you have, if you don't allocate it toward particular sources, you may not wind up with any more. And education is a statutory responsibility of the state of Illinois, and we have to uphold our responsibilities to our citizens. Moving away from property taxes has always been a goal of mine as an elected official for the last 25 years. I believe there's a lot of different sources that we can look at, but property taxes are an unfair way to fund schools because not everyone is blessed with the same equalized assessed valuation by which the money is derived from.
I'm speaking with Superintendent Bob Diber. He's one of six Democrats who are running for governor. Superintendent, one of the most controversial issues Governor Rauner faced last year, aside from the budget, was his signing of HB 40. That's the bill that covers abortions for Medicaid recipients and state workers, and it would also keep abortions legal in Illinois should Roe versus Wade be overturned. Would you have signed that bill, and why or why not?
I have publicly said that I would have signed the bill because I believe where we're at in society, that we do not want to return to the day of pre-Roe versus Wade. You know, I personally have been profound in the fact that I am pro-life, and I believe that's why Planned Parenthood did not endorse me. However, I've said that I would sign it, and I uphold the woman's right to choose. I don't believe in government interference in personal decisions. That's just really how I think our Constitution is written. And I know there may be individuals that are strong pro-life that disagree with me, and there may be individuals that are strong pro-choice that disagree with my position. But I look at myself as a rational person on this issue, and I think it's everybody's right to choose. And that's why I would have signed it.
Another big issue we're seeing is in regards to immigration. Do you think state resources should be used to help enforce federal immigration law when it comes to detention and deportation?
Well, I've said that I uphold the right of Illinois to be a sanctuary state, and I'm not for deporting immigrants because I do not want to create a state of orphans. We know that those children who were born in the United States and in Illinois have a right to remain here in their citizenship, and if we deport their parents, we're going to have to take care of their children. So I'm for trying to help immigrants become citizens of the state of Illinois, become productive citizens, be wage earners, be taxpayers, and live the American dream.
Superintendent Diber, the Chicago Tribune recently reported that Madison County paid $500,000 in 2010 to settle a lawsuit you were involved with. The jury rejected the claims of wage-based discrimination and violations of equal pay law, but did side with the plaintiff on the claim that you retaliated against her when she complained she didn't make the same as a male coworker. I should add the EEOC also dismissed this claim, but this was a separate legal action she filed. I wonder what your response is to voters who might see this and wonder how this squares with the very vocal statements you made about passing the Equal Rights Amendment.
Well, it's like this. I have worked to give women every opportunity, including in this case, opportunities to be successful and to elevate in their professional career. This was a misfortunate circumstance. I regret it. It was all because of state budget cuts. When you asked earlier about how I understand these and how we're affected, this was a direct line item cut in a truancy program. We had to do a reduction of staff. It had, and that's why I was found not guilty. It had nothing to do with sexual discrimination. The wage difference was established by my predecessor. I had nothing to do with setting this lady's salary. I tried to rectify the difference in it. The lady filed the EOC claim. It was dismissed. The factor of retaliation I disagreed with. I wanted to pursue this in the appellate court. The county board and the chairman believed that we were going to continue to increase cost on this. The jury actually awarded an insurance settlement on this. This was not a taxpayer settlement, and it didn't cost taxpayers $500,000 because Madison County did not exceed its limits of liability in this case. So that was why it was paid. I still disagree with the settlement because the lady was awarded only $100,000 in settlement by the jury. It was a summary of judgment settlement that a judge made that awarded the case what it wound up being.
Superintendent Diber, we just have a minute or two left, and I just wanted to ask you two last questions. First, why do you want to be governor?
Well, I have a deep concern about the state of Illinois and about its reputation and about its future. And I believe as governor, I can do several things. One, I have a solid plan in which to pay our bills and to move Illinois to more solid financial base, and that is to pay your bills, bond the bills out, reinvest our debt so we're not wasting what we are at high interest rates, move to a progressive tax plan, and then do something that Illinois just needs to do so bad, and that's develop a marketing plan for the good and the quality of this state. Illinois has so much to offer. There's so many good things going on in Illinois right now, and all we talk about is about the bad parts of the state of Illinois. Bob Diber will be a great marketer for this state. He will increase tourism in the state of Illinois even beyond the limits that it was in 2017. And I will work to drive and help people be successful here in business. And it is my goal that when I leave office, that we have a public school system in this state that doesn't rely on property taxes and that is being better funded by the state of Illinois. And for the first time, we're funding schools on time and not dismissing educators.
We just have about 30 seconds left, but I just want to ask you one last quick question. What's your favorite place to visit in Illinois?
My farm in Alhambra Township.
Why?
Because that's where I find peace of mind, and I just enjoy the country and reminisce about my childhood and past, and it's just a great place to be.
Bob Diver is the superintendent of the Madison County Regional Office of Education. He's been a school teacher, served on a village board, county board, and a township supervisor, and he's the only Democratic governor candidate out of six running for governor to be from outside the Chicago area. Superintendent Diver, thanks for being with me.
I really appreciate the opportunity to be on your show today. Thank you.
That does it for us today. As we said, the primaries on March 20th. On Monday, we'll be joined by Democratic candidate Teo Hardeman. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks to you for listening. Have a good weekend.